Thank you. Be seated. In the cause of Black and Others versus Victoria Lloyd's Insurance Company, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument and 10 minutes of rebuttal. And the court is ready to hear oral argument from petitioners.
May it please the court, Mr. James Conger and Jimmy Williamson will present argument for the petitioners. The conference will begin.
May it please the court, I think probably by now the court knows my name, but for the record, I'm James Cronzer, and we represent in this case, and I'm going to make some arguments on behalf of all three of the petitioners. Mr. Williamson will take 4 or 5 minutes to talk about standing to have made these claims. I have difficult time in this case, and this is not just a make-weight argument, understanding how the Court of Appeals failed to face what this court came down four square on in Bail. In Bail, the court held in no uncertain terms that if an insurance carrier, or anybody else for that matter, but primarily a carrier, engaged in deceptive or misleading practices, that would be calculated considering the totality of the circumstances to mislead an insured or anybody else, either by reason of the Deceptive Trade Practices Act 1746 or of the provisions of 2121 of the Insurance Code, a private cause of action was created for any person injured by that conduct. Now, both in the trial court and in the Court of Appeals, the court sustained in the trial court and upheld a summary judgment that the conduct of the carrier in this case was not a representation and obviously ergo not deceptive or misleading. It also held that there was no coverage provided by the policy. And finally, that none of these parties, Mr. Daniel, the insured, or his daughter, who was a permissive user and driving the pickup truck at the time of the accident, and our client, Mr. Black, who was the injured party. I've caused the clerk to place before you the matters relating to the policy, the insurance code provisions, and the regulations.
We don't have them yet.
Oh, excuse me. Well, they're not going to be neons that come popping out there and spell it all out for everybody, but it's easy. Provisions. First, I think we need to discuss some background. Mr. Daniel owned a pickup truck, which he hired out to the Statewide Trucking Company and Wood Brothers Transfer for use in connection with the work of that company. A policy was issued by this carrier, Victoria Lloyd's, to these two companies, Statewide Trucking and Wood Brothers, for Daniel had to pay the premiums. They were deducted from what he received from these Statewide Trucking and the others, and the other company. And he had to have, under the then existing 911A and B of the Motor Vehicle Act, Commercial Vehicle Act, he had to have a card in the cab. And that on page one of those documents placed before you is the card that was furnished to Mr. Daniel for use in his cab, so that if the highway patrol or somebody else stopped him, that he would know, I mean, it could show that, and that would be proof of coverage that satisfied the Commercial Vehicle Act. On January 1st of 1982, the legislature enacted the compulsory personal automobile laws at that time, requiring, as the court knows, that anybody engaged in the use of a vehicle for personal purposes had to have a minimum of $15,000 and $30,000 and $5,000 property damage. That act, however, had section 33, had a provision that exempted any person who had a policy that met 911 A and B, a commercial vehicle. And so that such a person as Mr. Daniel would be uncovered as to that aspect of the new act because of this exemptive provision. Because of the new act, and the president and counsel for Victoria Lloyds both testified and stated that they thought this new, which you see, well, the new card, which is on page 2, when it says this policy complies with the compulsory auto laws of the state of Texas, was furnished to him to meet the requirements of the January 1, 1982, 6701H Act. It's almost impossible for me to perceive how, if the president of Victoria Lloyds and their counsel thought that that's what it meant, to cover any potential liability for personal use of the vehicle, that it wouldn't be expected that Mr. Daniel would. Now, there's another feature of the policy. He was told it did not provide collision coverage. So he procured collision coverage at his own expense. The policy, which is numbered there on page 2, the GLA 0550, that policy has some also other misleading information in it. He was never given a copy of the policy for which he paid, the basic policy, that numbered policy. Had they done that simple thing, he could have determined what he had and didn't have.
How was he advised of the need to get collision coverage?
By his employers, the people that had took out the policy. He had to pay for it, for the policy.
His employer furnished a copy of the policy?
Beg pardon?
Was his employer furnished?
Yes, they had one, and we have one attached to our brief. He was not furnished that when he was paying for the policy.
How can the insurer force the employer to give him a copy of the policy?
You mean the insured?
How can the insurer, Victoria Lloyds, compel the employer to give the employee a copy of the policy?
I don't say that they can, Judge Heck, but I can say they knew that he was one. They knew he was one of the hired vehicles under the policy, and they could have, of course, advised him directly of the nature of the coverage. But let me point out something else about this second car. It tells Mr. Daniel or any permissive user what to do in the event of an accident. It tells him, don't drive by gold, don't stop at the jail. You stay there, don't give any statements to anybody. Phone us as soon as you can. No distinction is made between coverage that is personal or for commercial purposes. He the ultimate issue in this case for a jury resolution, and it cannot be resolved the other way by summary judgment, is there enough evidence here to indicate that Mr. Daniel would have procured this bobtail rider, which they provided, they had a bobtail rider that he could have procured had he known it, had anybody told him, including the company. Is there enough evidence to indicate that, or raise that fact issue, that he would have procured it had he known he did not have it? I think that question would have to be resolved absolutely.
Was the statement on the card, policy complies with compulsory auto laws of the state of Texas, true as long as the vehicle was in commercial use?
It is true, Judge Heck, that because of Section 33 of Article 6701H, the new compulsory law applicable to persons, it is true that that exempts from this 1535 coverage anybody that has commercial coverage on their vehicle. Now, that's a strange inconsistency and incongruity, as I think we all could agree, but it does exempt that. But the question is whether under the insurance code and the insurance regulations and the deceptive trade practices saying that any person injured as a result of misleading or deceptive practices, which we clearly say this would indicate to a reasonable person that he had coverage for not just commercial use, but under that policy when it makes these recitations and requires him to do things, it would not make any difference whether it was a personal use occurrence or a commercial use occurrence.
Mr. Cronzer?
Yes.
The question that I have is, looking at page 2, under insureds, it doesn't show him as an insured. It shows Wood Brothers and Statewide Trucking.
Well, that's true, Judge Hook, that he never dealt directly with the carrier. They procured this policy for him and for others similarly situated where they on their hired vehicle. Matter of fact, this policy expressly provides personal use coverage for two other classifications of vehicle, owned vehicles, without any more, and with which the proof that he said he was familiar in his affidavit on summary judgment. But he is not shown to be the insured, but he in fact is, and paid for the policy. He had to pay for it himself. He had to pay for his collision coverage that he asked for. He even got other forms of personal policy from them that would indicate he was clearly covered. Now, what are we talking about? Vail says that there is a personal cause of action for a misleading or deceptive act or conduct that a reasonably prudent person would interpret wrongly.
If Mr. Daniel had known what the compulsory auto laws of the state of Texas were, wouldn't he have known about the exemption for commercial use vehicles, and wouldn't he have known that maybe this covers it and maybe it doesn't?
Judge, even more simple than that. If they'd given him a copy of the policy.
Well, but what I'm saying to you is...
But if he'd known the intricacies, and all they needed to do to alert him was to say, for commercial use only. That's all they had to say on this card. That's the only word they had. They didn't have to tell every provision of the policy. And
why doesn't it apply? Why doesn't your argument apply equally to the expiration date of the policy and the limits of coverage and what kind of coverage is extended and so on?
Judge Heck, I suppose that gets to the core of the country. I don't say it doesn't. The purpose of the DTP...
It does say what it expires, as far as it does.
Yeah, it does. It does say that, but...
It gives you that information, but doesn't give you the detailed information.
That's true, but I believe the detective raised the question, couldn't there be other matters of coverage within the policy that you aren't told about here that you And I would agree with that, Judge Heck, but I'm saying the purpose, as this court has spelled out in Aranda, in Matthews, Arnold, and in great detail, the purpose of this legislation, both the insurance code deceptive practices part and the DTPA 1746, is to prevent any kind, not intended to overreach anybody, but which is misleading or deceptive. And I say it can be as to any provision if you don't make and give the assured who's a premium payer clearly what he's got and he doesn't. And I believe as you review this record, you will, I hope anyway, come to the conclusion that Mr. Daniel would have bought this coverage in spades had he been told or in any other wise advised of the type of coverage he had and he didn't have.
The carrier got the summary judgment in the trial court, right?
May pardon?
Yes, it got a summary judgment. And the Court of Appeals has affirmed that.
That's correct.
You're asking this court to hold and do what?
We're asking this court to say the summary judgment was erroneously entered and send it back for a trial on what we say these disputed fact issues of what Mr. Daniel knew, what he would have done, whether he was misled by these practices. We're not asking for rendition. Thank you.
May it please the court, Mr. Jimmy Williamson will present further arguments for the petition.
May it please the court, my name is Jimmy Williamson and I represent the petitioner C.O. Daniel and Lisa Sutter. I wanted to just briefly address the issue of standing because Victoria Lloyds has argued since there is no coverage, there can be no standing. That argument is self-defeating because if you predicate standing to pursue a DTPA claim or 2121 claim upon coverage, then you are in effect requiring privity. You are requiring a person to have a certain contractual status before they can pursue a 2121 claim. That is erroneous because 2121 clearly states that any person who's been injured can pursue that claim. Likewise, the DTPA cause of action requires consumer status. It does not require any particular contractual status.
How is Mr. Black consumed?
Mr. Black, because he purchased, paid for, and acquired the benefits of the insurance policy. I'm sorry, you said Black. Black. I was saying Mr. Daniels. That's okay. Mr. Black's standing is predicated on two. I was really speaking of Mr. Daniel and Ms. Sutter. Mr. Black's standing is predicated on two things. One is the assignment between the parties, and one is Dairyland. So Mr. Black's standing is going to be predicated either on Dairyland, which holds that people who are driving on the state highway are entitled to the benefit that the legislator gave them of that statutory protection. They're statutorily intended beneficiaries, I think is the wording in the Children's case. And the second way is the assignment between the parties, which is an appendix to the brief. After this case went to trial, and after Judge Gale heard the evidence, and Judge Gale rendered a judgment for Mr. Black and Mr. Sutter, there was an assignment entered into between the parties, and we say that assignment valid gives Mr. Black standing. The DTPA also requires consumer status. As such, it requires that one either seek or acquire benefits under the policy. C.O. Daniel did that. He acquired those benefits. What he did not know was what he did not acquire, which was personal use coverage. And I respectfully submit that you can't predicate C.O. Daniels or Lisa Sutter's right to proceed upon whether or not the technical terms of coverage exist. And in fact, the Aetna versus Marshall specifically says misrepresentations as to coverage are the very issues that are going to arise in this insurance field context. In that same regard, the other thing that's been brought up that Victoria Lloyds continues to argue is that since Lisa Sutter didn't talk to Victoria Lloyds and since Randall Black never talked to Victoria Lloyds, they could not in any way relied upon any statements by Victoria Lloyds. That's false. Reliance is not an element of either the 2121 cause of action nor is it an element of the DTPA cause of action. In fact, the legislature specifically considered reliance when it was defining producing cause under the DTPA in the 79 amendments, I think it's the 79 amendments, and rejected that standard. So you cannot use the fact that Lisa was not, Ms. Sutter, was not in any way relying. That is a legal, immaterial fact. And I don't think that's going to defeat standing for Ms. Sutter in the case.
Now, let me ask you a question. I think this case is predicated, or your argument is predicated on the fact that because the carrier did not stamp for commercial use only, that that is based on the representation. What about the argument that they failed to say coverage in the United States only for people living in the border? You're going to require the insurance company to say not valid in Mexico, not valid in the foreign country, and if they did not do that, that would be the basis of the representation?
That raises two points. One point that brings up, Justin Gonzalez, is that were they negligent in not giving us the policy? See, they made a decision not to give us the policy, not to give those drivers the policy. Was that a reasonable decision?
Who made that decision?
Huh? Victoria Lloyds made. Victoria Lloyds made that decision not to give every driver a policy, copy of the policy.
Nor a check was issued to buy the policy. I know that Mr. Daniel paid for the policy,
yes,
but did he pay the company and then the company in turn issued its check to Victoria Lloyds, or
yes,
did he pay the insurer directly?
His money was actually withheld from the trucking money he had coming from Wood Brothers. It would be withheld from his money to pay for insurance.
So as far as the insurance company knew, the money to purchase the policy came from the trucking company?
No, sir. I don't think that's true, because what the insurance company knew is the premiums, as I understand it, for that policy are based upon the routes and the administration and the number of trucks that are using those routes. So the insurance company knew what trucks were being used and what kind of routes they were running, because that is the way they based their premium charges.
How would the insurance company know who was paying the premiums?
I don't know.
Does the record contain information supplied to the insurance company with regard to who the drivers were, the driving records, the ownership of the vehicles?
Yes, because I think the president of Victoria Lloyds testified that he understood that, in fact, these drivers were being used. There were drivers going forward. There were different drivers working for Wood Brothers. Those were hired vehicles. He understood those vehicles were owned by the drivers themselves. C.O. Daniel owned his pickup truck, but had it under a written lease agreement to Wood Brothers, which was the customary way that Wood Brothers was doing business at the time. And it provided in there, that contract provided that Wood Brothers was to provide insurance.
Would it have been sufficient if they had simply added on the card something to the effect that if you want more details of the extent of coverage, get the policy, receive the policy?
That is exactly the point. The point is, if they had done that, would that conduct have been negligent or not? Would they then have provided enough information to discharge the burden of a reasonably prudent person? That is a question of fact that should be resolved by the trier of fact, not resolved by summary judgment. Likewise, that's the negligence issue, which I think answers Justice Gonzalez's question also. Likewise, would that conduct then be misleading? Would it be misleading under Board Order 18663 to a reasonably prudent person? Would that be an omission to state a material fact to a reasonably prudent person? That issue should be resolved by the trier of fact, not by summary judgment. If I've answered the question, I'll reserve. Thank you, Your Honor.
Is there any way you could draw a line where there would not be a fact issue? If they gave the whole policy, then there was no argument to be made that that was too confusing by fine print. I think there is no way. I mean, I'm trying to see if there is any way your argument to avoid.
It would be hard pressed. As a lawyer who works on the plaintiff's side of the bar, I would be hard-pressed to fault an insurance company who gave somebody an insurance policy by then saying, well, this policy is confusing, so therefore it's inherently misleading. I mean, so if they had just given the policy, I think I fail to see how that's going to be hard to make a misleading argument. Perhaps they could then engage in other conduct. And in fact, See, it's not just the language of the policy, it's the conduct. Not only the issuance of a card, but the omission to state the fact. It's all that conduct that we are claiming raises a fact issue on the misleading aspect of their transaction.
So you're saying 1746B, subparagraph 26.
That is one thing, yes, sir. Paragraph 26 or paragraph 23, the failure to state a fact.
23.
Well, may I clarify that, Justice Cook? Yes, we have made a claim under 1746.23, but quite frankly, I think the omission argument is stronger and easier to reach under Article 2121, Board Order 18663, which also says the omission to state a material fact necessary to make the statements made in light of the circumstances under which they're made, not misleading. The board orders also have an omission provision that we claim raises an issue of fact here, if that answers the court's inquiry.
Any other questions?
As far as avoiding or resolving this issue, rather, on summary judgment, I assume if they had stamped it not valid for personal use, that's something that could be resolved on summary judgment. They stamped the card that way on the facts of this case.
On the facts of this particular case, that may have done it. But again, we'd have to look at the entire record to see if the conduct of the insurance companies is misleading. Because questions of whether or not something is a misrepresentation, or question whether it's misleading, or question whether it's negligence, is just so inherently an issue of fact that it's hard to ever resolve it by summary judgment. So,
in that regard, with reference to the whole record here, are all the communications for the relevant period between the employers and the Victoria Lloyds in the record?
Well, I don't think we know of every communication that occurred between the employers and Victoria Lloyds, but certainly the deposition of the president of Victoria Lloyds is in the record, as is the deposition of the Wood Brothers representative.
Any indication that Victoria Lloyds ever requested the employer to advise of limitations or policy exceptions to the owners of the vehicles that it knew about?
No. Not that I am aware of, as I said here right now, Justice Tubby. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Court is ready to hear argument from response.
May it please the court, Mr. Michael Neal and Mr. Mark Wilson will present arguments for responses. Mr. Michael Neal will open.
Mark Wilson will open.
Mark Wilson will open.
May it please the Court, I am Mark Wilson with the firm of Neal and Seymour, and I'm going to just briefly discuss with you the issue of standing and also touch on the issue of the effectiveness of the summary judgment, and then Mike will address you on whether or not this was a misrepresentation. I want to talk to you first about Ms. Sudrith and her status as a consumer under the DTPA. It's our contention, and I believe it's correct, that Ms. Sudrith is not a consumer under the DTPA. She neither sought nor acquired services. The petitioners in this case have attempted to bring her within the DTPA by saying at one point in time she drove that vehicle when it was covered and thereby acquired the services. But if you take that argument, then anytime anyone drives someone else's vehicle that's a covered vehicle, then they have acquired the services. Until the memory of man runneth not to the contrary, that's just not logical sense. We can't extend it that far. If this accident had occurred at a time when Lisa Sudrith was driving the vehicle on a mission for Wood Brothers, then perhaps you could say she's a consumer. But if she's on a personal mission that is absolutely not covered by the policy, then she is not a consumer because she has neither sought nor acquired services. This lady never talked to Victoria Lloyds. This lady never talked to anybody about the policy and said, I want a policy of insurance. So she's just not a consumer. If she's not a consumer, obviously under the DTPA, she has no standing. As to 2121, she is not a person as defined by the case of Chaffin. And I don't have the last name of that case, but it's cited in the brief. Chaffin specifically says that a person does not extend beyond one who is either insured or a beneficiary of the policy. Now, it's obvious that when she's on a personal mission, she is not an insured. She is neither a beneficiary to the policy because this particular policy was a commercial policy that was intended to insure anyone who was driving the vehicle while
it was in employment. Perhaps an individual who is injured while that vehicle is being driven is an intended beneficiary if you follow the case of Dairyland versus Childress. But in this particular situation where there's no coverage for that, she is not an intended beneficiary. Therefore, she is not withstanding either under the DTPA or under Article 2121 of the Insurance Code. As to Mr. Black, the way the petitioner has attempted to get you to get standing for Mr. Black is to say that Mr. Black is an intended beneficiary under 6701H. But you see, this policy was not written under 6701H. This is a commercial policy that was written under the exception 6701H under the Texas Commerce.
What about this card you sent out? Was that sent out under 6701H?
Well, Your Honor, there's some question about just the real reason this card was sent out, if you will, is because there was a lot of questions from members of the law enforcement mind about whether or not that cab card said you had insurance. And the reason the card was sent out was to let people know, particularly law enforcement officers, that this car is covered by a policy of insurance and therefore don't write them a ticket saying they're not covered.
Is it correct that your client's president and general counsel thought that this was under 6701H?
It is correct that on deposition he testified that it was his understanding the card was issued because of 6701H. Yes, sir. Now, what he meant by that, Your Honor, I would not presume to say. I would suggest to you that he could just as easily have meant by that argument that because 6701H required proof of insurance in your vehicle, that the company felt like it would be in Wood Brothers' best interest to issue these cards to their drivers so they wouldn't get a ticket. But certainly no one ever intended, and I don't think the president of Victoria Lloyds intended to say that he thought that this card provided coverage under 6701H.
But the card doesn't say that.
The card doesn't say one way or the other.
In fact, it leads one to believe the contrary, doesn't it, by saying compulsory auto alarms?
I do not believe so, Your Honor. Yes? Oh, I'm sorry, I thought you had a question. That's what it is. All right. As to the assignment, if you'll just take a brief look at that assignment, you will see that the assignment is merely an agreement to split fees in case that the plaintiffs prevail in the case. It is not an assignment of a part of a cause of action. And absent being an assignment of a part of a cause of action does not give the Mr. Black any standing to bring this suit. I see I just have just a minute left, but I want to talk just real quickly, if I can, about what's necessary in bringing a summary judgment. The petitioners have indicated that because we didn't specifically say, now, misrepresentation, when we're talking about it here, means under the DTPA, and over here, under 2121, that our summary judgment is defective. I submit to you that this court, on numerous occasions, has specifically stated that as long as the a necessary element of a cause of action is squarely met, then the causes of action for which that element had been squarely met are met, and that's all you have to do. You do not have to say, okay, misrepresentation here, misrepresentation here, and misrepresentation over there. None of the cases, including Cheshire, specifically say that you have to specifically say this cause of action and this cause of action. The reason that you said what you did in Cheshire, as I understand it, was because the statute of frauds was not a defense to the other three causes of action that were never addressed in the summary judgment. In our case, misrepresentation was the crux of the entire case, and it was specifically and clearly addressed. And unless you have any further questions of me, I'm going to sit down and let Mr. Neal take over. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Counsel.
May it please the Court, Mr. Neal, now present further arguments
for response. May it please the Court. I'm Michael Neal of the firm of Neal and Seymour, and I represent Victoria Lloyds Insurance Company. There are three basic questions that I feel, if they're answered in the affirmatively, the court will see that the summary judgment in this case was correct. First of all, there was no coverage under the policy. That is determined very easily by reading the policy and the attached endorsements to the policy, which were endorsements approved by the Insurance Commission of the State of Texas, which exempted coverage for hired vehicles unless they were under the dispatch of Statewide Trucking and Wood Brothers and over a route approved by those employers.
That's all. Yes. That may be a cause of action for tort misrepresentation.
Well, that's one of the other three, one of the other points that I was going to make. Secondly, the card, as a matter of law, cannot create coverage under that policy. And thirdly, the card, as a matter of law, does not constitute misrepresentation, nor does any of the facts and circumstances surrounding the issuance of the card create or establish misrepresentation.
I think you can go to the third point.
All right.
I think everybody will be on the first.
All right. The misrepresentation question, first of all, the statement on the card is true. It's an identification card. This card was not issued for the purpose of selling insurance, was not issued for the purpose of getting anyone to change their position concerning insurance. It was just what it says on the very top of the card, that it was an identification card. That is what it says at the very top of the card. In fact, Victoria Lloyds may have been able to enhance their economic position had they not said the statement on the card and sold the bobtail insurance. This card obviously was not issued for Victoria Lloyds to profit or to cause anybody to change their position. This card was issued for just the purpose that was stated on the card as an identification card. The policy of insurance, which was a fleet policy, was already in place. The premiums were established on a gross receipts basis. I'm not sure that what Mr. Williamson said was exactly correct about knowing what routes and what vehicles were involved, but the premiums were established by the gross receipts received by Wood Brothers by virtue of their transport business. They in turn requested the hired truckers to reimburse them for the portion of the premium attributable to the receipts of each of those hired truckers, and they deducted that from the check. Therefore, this card was not issued in a marketing context and was not issued by any stretch of the imagination to get Mr. Daniel to change his position economically or otherwise. The card just simply is not a misrepresentation. Furthermore, the card was not issued in a claims context. This statement was not issued or was not made during the course of handling a claim to get anyone to change their position regarding the claim or to misrepresent coverage regarding the claim. There's just no way by any stretch of the imagination that you can say that this card constituted a misrepresentation that would have caused Mr. Daniel to change his position to the benefit of Victoria Lloyds or in regard to the claims handling procedure.
If the card had said this provides complete and comprehensive coverage for any use of this vehicle, would you have any of those arguments?
I can't imagine a carrier putting that on the card.
They may have here.
But I think it might. I mean, we've got general liability policies that are entitled comprehensive general liability policies. Now, if we write an insured, if a carrier writes an insured and say, on this date we have issued you a comprehensive general liability policy and it will be forwarded to you in the mail in the next 10 days, and a loss occurs during that 10 days, does that mean exemptions and exclusions that would be in that policy don't apply? I submit no, it would not. And in fact, the policy itself, and we cited several cases in our brief out of both Texas, the McNeil versus McDavid Oldsmobile case, and several cases out of other jurisdictions that say that a statement such as in a sales brochure or a caption on a policy or a caption on an application cannot be construed as a representation of the coverage provided by the policy or the exemptions and exclusions under the policy. And this statement on this card should be taken in the same context. It is a general description that there is a policy of insurance in place that provides coverage as required by the compulsory auto laws of the state of Texas. It doesn't say under 6701H, it doesn't say under 911A, 911B, or any of this.
Is the authority you're referring to under the Deceptive Practices Act, meaning misrepresentation?
I'm not sure about the McNeil case, and that's the only Texas authority that's in our brief. The others obviously are not because they're other jurisdictions.
Is it your contention that any representation in the sales brochure about coverage that varies with the eventual terms of the policy could not be actionable under any circumstances under the EPA, Article 2121?
If a statement varies with the terms of the policy, that's one thing. This statement doesn't vary with the terms of the policy. And under Bar Consultants and Hope, there were specific statements made that varied with the terms of the policy that the court said, okay, these constitute a waiver of the exclusion or these modify the policy.
Well,
but, okay, I'm sorry.
The previous argument to be that it didn't make any difference that you look solely for the policy and it doesn't make any difference what the sales literature said, that that was the effect of the case that you signed it to.
I'm sorry, I didn't.
Do I understand your previous argument to have been that you look solely to the terms of the policy and that it cannot be varied based on what's in the sales literature?
No, that is not my argument. No, I think that that's contrary to the well-established law of the state. Yes, the terms and conditions of the policies can be changed by other representations that are specific and inaccurate about the policy. We don't have that here. We've got a statement in the card that generally describes the policy, and it doesn't have any specific language saying that there is or is not any specific coverage. And
I guess returning to an earlier question then, if the card had said that this is for any and all uses, would all your other arguments fall?
I haven't thought of it that way because that's not the problem in this case. If it was, it would depend on how it was worded. If you worded it like that, this card represents a policy of insurance that covers this vehicle for any and all uses, no exception, including times of war and in Argentina and everywhere else, then yes, you would have modified the policy essentially by the representations in this card. But that's not what this card did. This card generally and accurately described a policy of insurance. It was a generic description of an automobile policy of insurance telling this person, you've got a policy of insurance that is in compliance with the laws of the state of Texas.
Telling what person?
Telling statewide and their driver. Statewide and Wood Brothers and their drivers, who obviously we can't say that we didn't anticipate that the drivers of Wood Brothers would get the card. We knew that, or Victoria Lloyds knew that. They were the named insured, and the cards were issued to them, and it had a general statement in there to put the law enforcement officer or whoever asked for proof of insurance when they stopped a person driving the vehicle. It said, Victoria Lloyds Insurance, this policy complies with the compulsory auto laws of the state of Texas. It did not go any further to represent any specific coverage or to represent that there were any exclusions to coverage.
Well, the point that I'd raised with Mr. Kronzer, which troubles me, is it doesn't mention Mr. Daniel being insured, employee of Wood Brothers, but it doesn't mention him as an individual.
That's correct. And he was not an individual insured. He's actually a contract driver, and there was a contract that's part of the record of this case that he contracted on a per diem basis to drive the Wood Brothers. And he was given this card as proof that he was covered with insurance while driving for Wood Brothers. And
was there ever any correspondence or communication between Victoria Lloyds and Mr. Daniel?
I'm not even sure, and this is contrary to what Mr. Williamson and Mr. Daniel have said, and I don't believe the record reflects this, that Victoria Lloyds had any specific knowledge that Mr. Daniel was a contract driver for Wood Brothers. They wrote a fleet policy covering the vehicles and charged the premium based on a gross receipts basis. There was no separate policy or any separate statement of coverage within the policy concerning Mr. Daniel. And it could be just like any large corporation, if you go to work for a large corporation and you operate one of their vehicles, you're covered by their auto liability coverage.
I noticed that this identification card on page 2 does not identify the vehicles And under most of these identification cards, it identifies the vehicle that is being insured. Is this, what was the reason for that? That's standard by the insurance carriers.
I don't know what's standard by the insurance carrier. I know I looked at my card yesterday, and it in fact has the identification of a specific vehicle. This, again, I don't know the thought processes or anything else of Victoria Lloyd's in issuing this. They issued, they gave cards to Wood Brothers and Statewide to give to their drivers so that they would have in their vehicles proof of insurance in the event they were stopped and asked to produce proof of insurance by a law enforcement officer. And
were there any cards issued in the record that named the driver individually?
I'm unaware of it. This is the only card that's ever been produced in this record.
Am I correct that under your interpretation of the policy that Mr. Daniel, as the owner of this vehicle, deviated off of his normal route to go to church or the local bar, that he would not have been covered had he had an accident?
That is the way the endorsement, TX0621, TX0617, I believe, are the two endorsements that are both approved by the Insurance Commission and were both attached to this policy. And that was the exclusion expressed in those endorsements. Furthermore, as far as misrepresentation is concerned, I think I've covered almost everything, but I would like to just point out to the court that there's no question, and I don't think that even the petitioner's question, that this was a true statement that was contained in the card. And so they go to Board Order 18663, which you have to go through the insurance code and to the board order to get to that, and they go to the two exceptions, or the two, I think it's sections 2 and 3 of the definition of misrepresentation, that say that a misrepresentation can be any omission to state a material fact necessary to make statements made considered in the light of the circumstances under which they are made not misleading. And I wasn't as good as Mr. Williamson. He had memorized that. Or the making of any statement in such a manner or order as to mislead a reasonably prudent person to a false conclusion of a material fact. I submit to you that this card was simply issued as a proof of insurance. It was titled an identification card. It did not omit to state any material fact. If we say that it did, then we've got problems anytime anybody marketing a product, whether it be insurance or anything else, and they make a true statement that has some possibility of being misinterpreted under some unusual fact situation.
What bothers me is that the notice doesn't say what was at issue here. And it seems to me that there's a jury question, or ought to be decided by a jury, as to whether or not there was any misleading there.
Your Honor, it's our position, and I feel a very strong position, that as a matter of law, this was not a misrepresentation or misleading. This was simply an identification card. It was not issued in a marketing or a claims context. It was simply issued to a person to carry in his vehicle as proof that there was a generic policy of insurance in effect that complied with the laws of the state of Texas.
I recognize the legitimacy of your position, but it seems like a jury ought to be deciding that, not us.
I don't believe that that is a jury issue, Your Honor. That's just simply, it's as a matter of law.
That means it's really, there's no question about it. Nobody can really genuinely, honestly,
intelligently
argue that it's not the case.
I don't believe,
say as a matter of law.
I don't believe that there's always a jury issue in a situation like this. I believe as a matter of law, this card being truthful and having been made in a non-marketing or a non-claims handling context, that this, as a matter of law, this card was not misrepresentation.
There's nothing on the face of the board order, 18663, that limits it stuff.
Well,
marketing.
We might have to get into my feelings about bail on this. And
well, you know, I'm not a real big fan of bail either, but nobody else went along with it.
I think that even setting bail aside, if we look at this card and the fact that it had truthful statements in it that as a matter of law, an identification card, and again, we need to look at McNeil versus McDavid Oldsmobile, I think helps us. And I think that Floral Consultants and some of the other out-of-jurisdiction cases that we cited in our brief that say that a caption or a descriptive brochure or the name of an application or something that generally describes the policy cannot create coverage or be a misrepresentation of the coverage. And I believe that that's what we have to look at in this case.
What I inquired about earlier, are those cases under the DCPA or the 2121?
Well, that, again, I have to give you the same. Okay. McNeil is, yes, under the DCPA. Mr. Wilson helped me out. I did not know the answer to that. The other cases that we cited are all out of this jurisdiction, and obviously they could not be under the DCPA.
Does the record reflect who told Mr. Daniel that Wood Brothers had liability but not collision coverage?
Mr. Daniel said that a person named Charlie, a female person named Charlie in the Wood Brothers office told him that, he believed, but he wasn't even sure of that, and that's the only evidence whatsoever that that statement was made in the record of this case.
Now, since he subsequently purchased the collision coverage, I'll forget that.
Okay.
Any other questions? Thank you, Your
Honor. Thank you, Your Honor.
I may please the court, Mr. Chief Justice, I was aware that you weren't totally persuaded by the logic of the veil.
Well, I don't understand it, but apparently you do.
Well, I would understand anything that I thought was in my favor.
That's right.
But I'm not going to try to hide behind that truism.
Mr. Roger, what evidence of representation is there in this record that leads to the fact that you were misrepresented?
Well, this, if the court please, this was not a tab card, the one on page 2. This was issued by Victoria Lloyds, as the president and counsel said, as this record says, to demonstrate you have all compulsory liability coverages. And while it is true, Judge Gonzalez, that Section 33 of the then new Compulsory Act exempted insurance carriage where there was compulsory on hired vehicles, that doesn't change the deceptive nature of it. What anybody that reads that clause, I mean that second clause, has to come to two conclusions. The first conclusion is that whoever is operating it, either as the primary assured or as a permissive user assured, has coverage for any personal use. That's what it says. And how is that bolstered? Regardless of whether the accident occurred in commercial use or in personal use, it tells the people to whom this card was disseminated what they had to do in the event of an accident. No distinction is made there.
Isn't that good advice, whether you're on commercial business or personal business?
Well, it isn't good advice, Judge Heck, to phone your agent, the insurance company on West Alabama, that when they say we're not your agent. That's not very good advice. That'd be maybe the worst thing. But see, it's telling you, irrespective of the nature of the occurrence, what you go about doing. Protect us, don't go out there negotiating with people and the rest of the stuff that you know. But the only thing it protects you from is don't give the other side statements. But an uninsured motorist, which they claim is the case here, that's almost the perfect legal defense, non-est pluribus unum. And what we're, that means no money, Judge, no pockets. What I'm saying is this card, the second card, which was unnecessary for them to have issued, under their own reasoning, that because it didn't cover personal use, it didn't have to be sent at all. Now, if that's true, you go into the negligence area, Colonial versus Taylor, and Rule 323, if you start into a course of conduct, you send this thing out there, you ought to tell them everything about it. But I want to at least make two more observations. One, in response to Judge Heck's inquiry, can we assume if a jury were to find the facts as we're claiming that we should be entitled to go with it? Judge, if it is a deceptive practice, misleading practice, if the court please, it, in effect, makes for coverage while it's being used personally. That's the necessary bottom line of the Vail case. It provides that there was personal use coverage for the failure to have explained it.
Mr. Condon, doesn't your position require a determination that if an insurer issues a card like this to anybody, it creates a fact issue whether or not that person that was driving the auto at the time of the accident was covered by some kind of policy of insurance?
If he gets one like the second one? Or the,
yes.
The first one's the one he's required to carry in the cab.
Cab car. Yes. But if he gets car. If he gets this ID card, whatever they call it, but the second card that we've been talking about, if he gets that, then there's always going to be a fact question based upon this statement whether or not there was some kind of coverage that covered
it. Not necessarily, Your Honor. Only if it is violated of the DTPA provisions and the code provisions.
But how would it not be?
Beg pardon?
How would it not be? Under what circumstances?
Because it's
would
a,
not
be? It's a test of the reasonable man. What would a reasonable person receiving that, driving his car, believe?
That's what I mean. So it would be a fact question.
Yes, I've done a bad job. If I haven't suggested that we think that the summary judgment was improperly granted and sustained, because any person reading that second card would believe that he had coverage. You only can go to the policy to find out you don't. That's the only way you can determine you don't. And the regulations that were passed and have been approbated in Vail, this one says, any omission to state a material fact necessary to make statements made, that is, that you're covered by all compulsory liability law, considered in the light of the circumstances under which they are made, is any omission that is not misleading. And if that doesn't cover this one like a blanket, and I honestly say that you would be required to either overrule Vail or engage in conceptual thinking, how many angels can stand on a pinpoint to find a distinction between the two.
Victoria Lloyd had sent one of these cards to the trucking company?
No, they sent them to a bunch.
But they had only sent one. Just their computers spit out, one card for each policy. And then the trucking company had made duplicates to put around with each driver or each truck, however this was done. Would the case be different?
Judge, I guess what we're talking about, what is a jury issue? What is a true fact issue?
From the fact that they sent a stack of these cards and therefore Victoria Lloyd knew it.
But I think you have to take with that the fact they never gave him a copy of the policy he was paying for. He paid for collision coverage when he learned he had to have it. The second card itself tells him what he's got to do in the event of an accident. And the question is, would Mr. Daniel, under the totality of the circumstances, have a right to reasonably believe that when his pickup truck was being used for personal purposes, that he had coverage? Now, I say that flows from 2121, 1746, and the regulations, which, if I don't misread Vail does say that any person injured as a result of these deceptive or misleading practices has a private cause of action to repair the damage caused. And we do think that the fact issues are here. And that's the way I read Bates.
Is it a necessary part of the case that Victoria Lloyd sent multiple copies of these two cards so that they knew they would be distributed to these people?
Well, I think they knew they would, but their rates were computed on the basis of their mileage factors, earning factors, and
it's necessary that to your creating a fact issue that Victoria Lloyd knew that this information would get to the hands of the drivers.
No, that's you're really into foreseeability, proximate causation in connection with the reasonable conduct.
I'm not really trying to get into that. I'm trying to get into what the communication going to these individuals.
Well, when you read what the president's testimony and the council's testimony, I believe that gap, that circuit is closed, Mr. Chief Justice.
I'm trying to understand what it was.
That circuit is closed because they said the purpose of that car, which they realized got in the hands of this man, Daniel, was to assure him that he had compliance with the compulsory auto law.
My question is just, is that a necessary element of your having a fact issue?
Is if they don't know, or if they just back there printing them up in their little print shop, and they're not sending them out generically, or not sending them to be distributed to people that are operating these trucks for Wood and them, then I would say that'd be an awful strong fact against us.
Okay, that, I'm just trying to... Mm-hmm. So it didn't really make a lot of difference, does it, whether the card was sent or not, because
they got there.
Your man didn't get the information. He didn't get it where he discovered it.
That's right. Thank you very much for your patience.
Thank you. That concludes the argument in the second clause. We'll take another.